Good evening, you're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM, and this is another edition of Little Atoms with me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is a show about ideas. Each show features a guest from the worlds of science, journalism, politics, academia, human rights, or the arts in conversation. If the show can be said to have a dominant theme, then it's the ideas of the Enlightenment, by which we mean such things as freedom of expression, free inquiry, empirical rationalism, scepticism, the scientific method, secular humanism, and liberal democracy. Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. This week's show features a pre-recorded interview with the author and journalist John O'Farrell. John O'Farrell has published three novels, The Best a Man Can Get, This Is Your Life, and May Contain Nuts, a memoir of his support for the Labour Party during its wilderness years, Things Can Only Get Better, and three collections of his Guardian column, Global Village Idiot, I Blame the Scapegoats, and I Have a Bream. He is a former comedy scriptwriter for Mel Smith and Griff Rhys-Jones and for Spit and Image, and is the founder of the satirical website Newsbiscuit. He can often be seen on such television programmes as Grumpy Old Men, Newsnight Review, and Have I Got News For You. John's latest book is called An Utterly Impartial History of Britain, or 2,000 Years of Upper Class Idiots in Charge. I hope you enjoy the interview. John, thanks very much for talking to Little Atoms.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on the show.
Your new book is called An Utterly Impartial History of Britain,
indeed,
or the subtitle 2,000 Years of Upper Class Idiots in Charge.
Yeah.
So I suppose you should tell us what it's about first.
Well, it's a sort of proper history book, except it's got jokes all the way through. So I take the history of Britain from before the Romans landed in 55 BC and track the following 2,000 years right up to the end of World War II, but with a sort of same comedic scepticism that we have for today's politicians. It always seems bizarre to me that while, you know, we mock and satirize today's leaders, we talk in revered tones about the likes of Henry VIII, and who is a sort of, you know, misogynistic wife murderer. So it's a sort of applying a Spitting Image and Have I Got News For You mentality that I used all those years on TV shows to British leaders and policies of the past.
Now, I would have thought that was quite uncontroversial, really, considering we're talking about 2,000-year-old history. But I was perusing some of the reviews on Amazon.
Oh, yes.
And a few people were quite taking exception to that. Some of the where you'd got sort of not so good reviews, they were sort of saying, well, you can tell what his politics are, you can see his sort of politics coming through, and comparing this to your sort of treatment of 1500 years ago leaders, okay?
Yeah.
Which I thought was quite
Well, amazing. I mean, I did compare Ethelred. I did say Ethelred the Unready was like, you know, the worst leader in Britain, had been possibly sex with Mrs. Thatcher, so, you know, and King John or something. So, obviously, I'm going to use my reference points. You know, people know from the title that this isn't going to be a standard,
sure,
serious historic tome, but, you know, the battles are in the right order, and the kings and queens are all there with their, you know, with what they did and what my opinion of them is. But, you know, I think it helps if you're trying to explain the solution of the monasteries to say, well, it was a bit like the privatization of telecom. You know, they took a state asset, they flogged it off, and made loads of money out of it, and suddenly people go, oh, I get it, right, okay, it's like that. And you know, if you're talking about, I don't know, the Vikings or the you know, the Norman conquest, I talk about immigration, and I talk about how much better it is now, and how much, you know, how Britain is an enriched country today because of all those waves of different sort of emigrants that came from other shores.
Why did you write a history book? Why did you think it was? Why did you choose this subject, and why did you think it was important?
Well, I had to write a column in the Guardian for 5 years, and that was, you know, my sort of take on current affairs. And whenever I sort of flash back to any point in history when I was writing jokes about, you know, if I was doing Anglo-French relations, and I'd suddenly sort of veer off and talk about Joan of Arc, I always found the jokes coming quite sort of easily, and they're always rather enjoyable doing. I always like anachronism jokes. So I thought, well, actually, there is a story to be told here. Do the whole history of Britain as an informative book, a bit like the Bill Bryson science book. In the way that he sort of made those difficult subjects accessible. Loads of people say, wish I knew more about history, but I just didn't really listen at school. And I thought, well, that's a shame, because history is a rich and fascinating subject, unless you get stuck with the Whig oligarchy. I admit that is boring.
Well, do you think, you're the chair of governors at a school, so yes. The teaching of history is obviously something that concerns you. So do you think history is boring in the way it's taught?
I think it is history in the way it was taught. I've mentioned my old history teacher in the introduction to the book, who who used to like a beer at lunchtime, and so depending on whether you had history in the morning or afternoon, the mood of the period was completely altered. Before lunchtime it was really irritable and grumpy, and no wonder there were so many murders and witch burnings. And in the afternoon, after you'd been to the pub, it was like everyone was a bloody great bloke, and you sort of got the feeling that the Hitler's Munich conference took place in the Hand and Flowers pub in Queen Street. It was that sort of atmosphere to the lessons. But there was a lot of take notes from chapter 7, and just you're supposed to sort of just read the books. Whereas I look at my kids' history lessons now, and they're really brought to life, and they're interesting, and they're challenging of what is taught. So they're studying propaganda, and is this true what we've been told, which is interesting.
What's the difference then?
The difference is, they're taught to question sources, I suppose.
Yeah.
Well, I remember being taught the Chartists at school, and the petition was invalid because there were joke signatories on it. And I remember even at the age of sort of 16, I remember thinking, well, hang on a minute, they still got millions of signatories. That's still pretty good. And of course, there were gonna be some jokers who put down Mr. Punch and Queen Victoria, but it doesn't mean that it wasn't a valid sort of campaigning movement. And that was even me at 16, 17 thinking, hang on a minute. Whereas now you do both angles of it, and you look at the Chartists, their place in history, and whether they were successful or not. And I sort of argue in the book that they were, because eventually we got all the things that they demanded, but just not in their lifetime.
Okay. Well, I want to sort of talk about the process of writing it, if we can, because comedic writing it obviously takes a certain skill, and it's all in. I was just reading an interview with you on a website. You'd written the quote, comedy writing in particular so depends on careful sentence construction.
Yes, it does,
which is like a sort of, I suppose, a parallel with the timing of a stand-up comic.
Absolutely.
How do you sort of intertwine being able to write in the sort of comedic style with writing a historic, factual non-fiction?
Well, one of the things you've got to do as a writer is be versatile. So, I've written for Spitting Image Puppets, I've written for TV presenters, I've written for Plasticine Chickens in Chicken Run, I've written sitcoms, so you put your head, get your head around a particular voice, and that's how you deliver the comedy. The voice I have in my books is sort of my own non-fiction, chatty, slightly sceptical, laid-back sort of easy sentence construction. But that's not to say there isn't timing in it, and sometimes, the important, just in pure technical craft terms, you want to detonate the joke as late as possible in the sentence. So if you can have the reveal in the very last word, that's much better. I remember the final line of Things Can Only Get Better is about me delivering some leaflets. And I said, I took some leaflets. I hadn't changed. I took these leaflets, and a week later, they're all delivered, every single one. I paid our au pair £5 to do them for me. And that every single one is a beat in this delivery of it. I took the leaflets and they were delivered. I got the au pair to deliver them for me. That's not quite as good. So I put that every single one. It just gives you a moment just to go, okay, you deliver them all. And then you deliver the punchline. It's just like the little look to the camera that a presenter might do. Do you know what I mean? I remember sticking that in and thinking, yeah, that feels better with the rhythm of it now. So that's just sort of craft you learn from being 20 years as a gag writer, I suppose.
Okay. The last edition of the show, we had the writer Howard Jacobson on, and we got into a discussion about, there'd been some survey recently that said that men in particular were not reading novels anymore.
That's true, 70% of novels bought by women now.
So men are reading non-fiction and history in particular.
Yeah.
I just wanted to get your take on this, really, as you've written novels and non-fiction and now a history.
Yes. I mean, this book is being bought by a lot of people for their for dads and husbands for Christmas, I think. There's quite a few women I know who bought it as well. The novels. My first novel, The Best a Man Can Get, was about a bloke in a bloke's internal monologue, but it was about his relationship with his wife and about having babies. So that appealed to women.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of managed to straddle both markets there. But this history book, I don't know, maybe I'll lose a few women in this. But I you know, when I do when Russell Brand does a concert, there's loads of beautiful women. When I when I do a library reading, there's loads of 65-year-old ladies from their reading groups, and we have our different markets, me and Russ. I don't sort of crowd surf with them in the same way.
Okay, well, you mentioned a few moments ago you started off writing comedy for TV show Spitting Image, and Mel Smith and Griffith Jones, and then you did the column in The Guardian. You sort of stopped all of that and have written a few novels.
Yeah, it's casual, isn't it?
You're also the sort of creator or co-creator of a satirical website called News Biscuit.
Yes, indeed.
And I'd like to talk about that for a bit. I wonder if this is where this comes from. This is your sort of outlet for the sort of satirical stuff that would have been in the column.
Yeah, quite consciously, actually. I mean, when I've been in the column for 5 years, I thought, oh, I'm fed up doing this now. I'd like to do something different. So whereas the column got read by hundreds of thousands of people around the world, and I got lots of response, I thought, now I'll do something that costs me money and doesn't get seen by as many people. So that was my career decision at the time. But I remember the editor of The Guardian saying to me that the long term fortune of the forecast for newspapers is not a good one, and I'm thinking, oh, maybe the internet. And I said, what is there in Britain on the internet? And there's not a great deal. There's quite a few sort of sites out there, but nothing like The Onion in this country. And I thought it would be great to start something up, and at the same time try and start up a sort of an outlet for new writers in the way that I came up through BBC Radio Light Entertainment and met other writers there. So this is happening online now, which is great. People are submitting their ideas, I rework them. Or sometimes they're good enough to go straight on the front page. But every day there's a new story, usually these days written by someone other than me, which is great. And other writers can rate each other's stories. They can rewrite each other's stories online. But at the end of the day, it's also a funny, free little thing for when you're bored at work to just click on and see what the funny news story is that day.
So tell us more about the how that works then. How big is the sort of pool of writers?
I've met one or two of them, but generally I on the submissions board there's probably 20 odd names that I recognise regularly.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes there's, last week there was a story that got, the first time this guy had submitted, he got, it was good enough to go almost straight onto the front page. Most of them I've never met. I've got a guy who does fantastic pictures for me called Rob D, who lives down in Midhurst in Sussex, and I email him and he sees the stories and knocks something up. And every day all these writers and all the people who've submitted are clicking on the News Biscuit, see their stuff's got on the front page, just in the way that I used to listen to Weekending and go, the bastards, they didn't use my story. And but then maybe next day it's on, it's great. You see all the chat room, them all going, oh, I got my front page, it's my first front page or whatever. And that feels great to be sort of bringing on writers and put, rewriting their stuff and saying, well, hopefully they're looking at it and going, this is interesting. He did this and changed that and, took out all the rude stuff. And sometimes, they might debate it and say, oh, I didn't think you made that as good. You could have made it better this way. And that's fine as well.
So literally anybody can submit something, can
Absolutely,
they?
Yeah. There's an open submissions board that you post your stories up there. Other people then, it's then exposed for the world to comment on and put star ratings on, which is probably quite brutal because, people can be quite harsh.
Well, especially on the web.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I mean, when I started up the site, there was loads of sort of bizarre sort of psychos who were slagging me off. But it's, I don't make any money out of it. And I'm not, if I do publish a book or do a radio series, then everyone will get duly recompense. But at the moment, it's just for the love of it, really.
So is there any... is writing for the internet different in any way to writing, say, The Guardian column? I mean, is it any different at all?
Yeah, it is, actually. I base it on the premise that people's concentration spans are shorter. So, when you write for The Guardian, people are sitting in a cafe or on the train and they're reading 850 words. When they are reading on the internet, they've got their mouse hovering over all sorts of different things, and if they get bored quickly, they're off. And it's like, since remote controls, TV has had to be different. It's got to be sharper and more scene changes more going on. You know, if you look at old TV shows, before when people had to get up and change the channel, the scenes lasted a lot longer.
Are you doing any satirical writing for any other outlets? I mean, politically at the minute, there's loads of stuff going on that it must be sort of.
Yeah, no, I use it. I've got me a website really, so if I have an idea, that seems like the most natural
yeah,
outlet.
Yeah, of course.
I just haven't done telly for quite a while, really. I mean, in terms of writing behind the scenes, every now and then I get asked to go on Have I Got News For You or something, or even Newsnight or something. I might, you know, get something off my chest there. But, no, I'm sort of writing my books and got my website and I've got the school and I've got the bits of broadcasting. So
quite busy.
I've got enough to be going on with. Yeah.
Okay. Well, as we're a show concerned with things of the left, I can't really let you get away without talking about Things Can Only Get Better, your memoir, for a bit.
Yeah, sure.
So we've had, 12, 13 years now since the end of that book, when they actually came to power. I've been quite surprised recently to hear even Labour Party supporters talking about how they're running out of energy and perhaps there should be, you know, imposed at the term limits and perhaps what the Labour Party needs to refresh itself is a period in opposition. Now, Things Can Only Get Better was about, basically, the theme was the futility of all those years in the wilderness. So do you think a period in opposition could do Labour any good?
Well, it will come eventually, of course, but no, I don't think it would do Labour any good at all. I mean, there's nothing worthwhile or enjoyable or desirable about opposition, because what they're saying is, I think it would be good to have the Tories in power.
Well, that's the downside. Yeah,
yeah, well, David Cameron, you know, this old Etonian running, sort of being in charge of things like child benefit and child income support. You're thinking, well, he's got no idea. So, and the idea that we'll get straight back in next time, you know, is what we thought in '79, and it might be another whole generation before Labour got back in if we had a period in opposition. So, if anyone genuinely thinks that we should just let ourselves be in opposition for a bit, I would recommend they go and read Things Are Going to Get Better again, just remind themselves how dreadful it is and how miserable it is just to be not only losing elections, but have the country governed by people who just have no idea of what it's like for ordinary people living in ordinary homes, you know, on low wages, because it's a different, you know, even if you're a sort of Tony Blair public schoolboy prime minister, you have a Labour constituency with, you know, ordinary people, and you canvass them and you have them come into your surgeries and you get an understanding that what life is like for most people, which just doesn't happen to the likes of David Cameron.
Did you find, I mean, I suppose there was the war, which is the sort of obvious thing, but I found the animosity towards Blair amongst Labour supporters themselves towards the end just unbelievable. I mean,
well, if you remember that, actually, they were pretty cross about stupid things like the dome. I mean, I got to interview the Prime Minister on YouTube about a couple of months before he stepped down. And my opening question to him is, don't you sort of feel nostalgic now for when people were just really cross with you about the dome? Because I remember I was a candidate in 2001, and people would hold it up as if proof. You know, this government's terrible. Look at the dome. And you're thinking, I've forgotten about that. It's such rubbish, you know. And clearly the war has been, you know, incredibly damaging and, you know, thousands dead and, you know, and terrible situation in the Middle East. So no one's going to hold that up and go, well, yeah, but. But Tony Blair, he was a sincere bloke, trying to do his best and achieved an incredible amount. And this country is, you know, much more at peace with itself. The people at the bottom of the pile have a much higher quality of life. And, you know, we forget. I was a school governor in the 80s, and we were arguing about whether we spent money on books for kids or stopping the roof water coming in through the roof. You know, and now we're building all these new schools, and I'm a school governor going, what do we do with all this money? It's fantastic. So people forget, you know, and they just want to be cross. And people on the left, actually, there's a certain bunch of people on the left who are much more comfortable being against everything.
I think that's it. They're more comfortable.
They're sort of oppositionalists. You know, when we campaigned for this school in Lambeth, there's a whole bunch of us who are like, there's some people who are great. They're out protesting and marching and signing petitions. And then it was time we got the school and time to be governors and, you know, and make decisions like, I'm against this and I'm against that. Yeah, okay, you're going to help actually organise with put up the pictures in the corridors. Well, I don't think we should have them. It's like they just want to fight, you know, and that's, there's a place for them, but they get, you know, but not in government, sadly.
Well, you just mentioned briefly about Maidenhead. Tell us about when you stood as a candidate and it was made into a TV programme, Losing My Maidenhead.
Indeed,
just tell
yeah.
us a little bit about that. Yeah,
the BBC gave it the title Losing My Maidenhead before the actual election, which gave me a clue of what they expected me
conclusion.
To do. Yes. Yeah, well, I mean, I'd written Things Can Only Get Better, which had been a surprise hit to me, and it sort of opened lots of doors, and the book was an account of me losing elections at every level, and I thought, actually, there's still one challenge, you know, to my scalp. And so I thought, well, I'll go and stand in my hometown where I grew up in rock-solid Tory Maidenhead, where my parents still lived. And, you know, some men have a midlife crisis and look at their old girlfriends. I went back to my hometown and was rejected en masse by the people I grew up with, which is vaguely therapeutic in a sort of perverse sort of way, you know.
Right, well, we're running out of time. It's gone really quickly. So it's just time to say... An Utterly Impartial History of Britain by John O'Farrell. Who's it published by?
It's published by Doubleday.
I
think it's some websites like Amazon. I think they pay you. It's so discounted. They pay you if you buy it. So.
And we've still got a couple of shopping days until Christmas.
We've got a couple of shopping days until Christmas. Out. It's piled up. And, it's just a funny and informative history book that you can dip in and out of. It's a big, fat book, but you don't have to read it all. You know, just think, well, I never knew about Edward II. My mum says, whenever I can't get to sleep, I just read a few pages of your book and I'm out like that, John. It's marvellous. So
that's a recommendation. John, thanks very much for speaking to Little Adams today.
Thanks a lot. Cheers. Good night.
Thanks for listening. We're taking a 2-week break for Christmas. We're back on the 11th of January with Claire Fox of the Institute of Ideas. So, Merry Christmas, and we'll see you in 2 weeks. Thank you.